Oh, hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are. We're in the Tech Lounge. Plop yourself down.
It's a 24-hour party.
Yeah. Plop yourself down on the couch. Grab a sparkling beverage of your choice or something stronger depending on the time of day. And we're here to, we're here to tell you a bit of tech news, things that are capturing our interest at the moment, things that we want to share with you and we think you also find interesting. How are you, Chris?
I'm all right. I don't know if it'll tell on the recording. I'm having some weird sinus allergy. It's that time of year thing.
It is spring. Spring fever. Live and well.
Yeah. It's not quite spring, but it was for a couple of days and it seems to have sparked everybody off.
It's true.
So I sound like I have a cold. I don't. I just have got a lot of crap going on in my
nasal cavities.
Anyway, so I will sound a bit gruff and I do apologize, but generally speaking, I am good.
Excellent.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I have a busy afternoon, but I have, you know, an afternoon free of interviews besides this one, of course, our podcast. Have you called that an interview? I'm not sure.
This is not an interview. This is a conversation.
So I will have time to double down and get a little bit of, you know, thinking work done, which is, you know, always in short supply when time-wise when you're a journalist these days.
On the subject of productivity, before we get started, Kate, let's talk about some sponsors of the show. Now, Setapp, the Mac app subscription service, we have both been using it for a little while, I think. I personally use Timings to track my time. I use Better Touch Tool to do all sorts of cool, crazy stuff. I use Ulysses to do writing. Actually, to be honest with you, I use so many, sometimes I forget what I'm using. Let's have a quick look. What else have I got?
There is so many to choose from. I use MoneyWiz.
Oh, yes, we both use MoneyWiz.
I have used the download YouTube videos, Downing, for various
although that one has some issues with YouTube, but it's not the app's fault. It's YouTube. Yeah, NotePlan I've been loving a lot recently as well. Anyway, and we've also, it's from MacPaw, who are based in Kyiv. Mm-hmm. Now, I visited their Kyiv and Boston office. We visited their Boston office together, didn't
yes.
we? I think. Yeah. But it's actually pretty cool. $9.99 a month. For, I wouldn't say hundreds, but I'd say up to about 100 applications from all sorts of uses.
I can also recommend Clean My App, by the way, which I've also found very useful.
Yes. That's also quite
apologies
cool.
for interrupting. Kind of I just thought I'd pop that one in there as it's a, you know, a standout as far as I'm concerned.
If you are interested in getting a discount off of that subscription and get a little bit of money for Tech Lounge, then head on over to, and I have some new links now, some new vanity links.
Vanity links.
go.christiangillett.com/setup. Neat, eh?
And you'll have that in the show notes?
Of course.
Excellent. I think you also missed a couple of important points about MacBook. Their setup of their Kyiv office and the museum.
Oh yeah, actually, well we could run off the ad installation. I'm interested to know if the museum is still there at the moment. But yeah, I did visit their Mac Museum 2017, 2018 in Kyiv. To be precise, their Apple Museum, because they are a Mac software company and they have an Apple Museum and they have Office Cats who have their own Slack channel. Which
you cannot complain about that. That's the kind of place where if you want your employer for the listeners, if you want your employees to return to work, these are the kinds of things you put in.
Yes, although we should point out that Kyiv is having its own concerns at the moment, of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I would say as a company, they have been very generous in supporting their workers, both in Kyiv and also remote workers, obviously, and in Boston.
Yeah.
We visited the office in Cambridge. They had a bunch of initiatives.
Cambridge,
yes,
Massachusetts.
They had a bunch of initiatives there they were undertaking, including they were showcasing some Kyiv tech, which was great, some of the robotics and things that the region is known for.
I think there's a photo of you doing something with some of them.
It's actually one of the companies I've written about, which is kind of nice. I think it was Juice Robotics, if I remember correctly. And they also had, I guess, emergency backpacks for people so that they could, you know, be able just have some emergency rations and safety things like first aid kits that you would hope you never need, but the reality of living in a war zone is you do need them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Indeed. Yeah. Good company. Very good company. Good service. I'm not technically doing an ad read right now, but I hear it.
I think they're a great story, you know, and they show how you can be a, you know, an international success by having great products, creating something people need, and then being able to scale it successfully, which is often what we're talking about.
You should help me with all my ad reads, Kate, because.
Well, I can talk about the ones I know about. The other ones, it's a little bit harder.
Do you mean you don't know about Git GUIs?
No. I'm not a developer.
Okay, then, with that out of the way, who wants to kick off this week?
I can kick off.
All right, go
for it. Mine is not necessarily new news, like it's not this week's news, but it's a kind of a combination of some different things that I'm seeing a lot of in my work, and I'm constantly sort of writing about, and I think it's a really interesting space, which is mental health in tech. And it encompasses everything from biotech, where we're looking at things like drug discoveries, to therapeutic options like wearable tech is one example, to digital platforms like digital therapies. And I wanted to mention just a few different examples that I think kind of really highlight the space. The first one is one that people may be familiar with, maybe not, which is Berkeley SciTech, a UK psychedelic medicine company. And their remit is basically turning drugs into licensed pharmaceutical medicine. And what they're looking at is neuropsychiatric diseases. These are things that have been identified as having a psychiatric background. And their market is people who've been unable to find relief from existing therapies. So, for example, someone with intractable depression, they've tried all the pharmaceuticals, they've done the therapy, the counselling, changed the lifestyle, what have you, and they're not getting the relief. And what's interesting about a lot of these companies is, firstly, they're putting a very scientific approach to something that has been, you know, around since the 60s, probably a bit earlier, which is the use of psychotherapeutics.
Berkeley is a very appropriate name.
Yeah. And it also demonstrates that they're finding success, you know. Like when I've interviewed a number of companies in the space, and when someone tells you, like, you know, without, you know, a drug trial, we had 40% of people had relief from the first stage. That's, you know, that's pretty spectacular, you know. And this is obviously the kind of therapy where you're not going to go and trip in a field. You know, we're not talking about those kinds of things. It's very strictly controlled. It's both in terms of a trial, but also in terms of the delivery. They also have this therapy in Australia and Germany, by the way. The therapists have to have appropriate training. It has to be done on site usually. It has a strong counseling component as well. It's not just like, you know, you take a drug and put some headphones on. So it's very, you know, it just shows you the way that you can advance sort of layers of something that people have been working on by, you know, finding ways of enhancing it.
Yeah.
And I think this is, you know, I can't remember if last time I told you, but I went to a health tech conference, biotech conference in Riyadh recently. And a lot of that was talking about a very scientific base for healthcare. And one of the things they were talking about was the fact that, you know, the number of drugs that fail at the first trial. And it was, you know, I think it was 90%, which when you think about how expensive these drug trials are, is extremely problematic.
Well, I guess if they fall at the first hurdle, they're less expensive than falling at the 10th.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. But I mean,
this was actually bizarrely, I watched this film, this Mickey 17 the other day, this Expendables program. And that's kind of part of the plot was that they took this person who could be recreated into space to test things on him, basically.
Actually, I will.
So if he died, it didn't matter.
Apologies, I just checked my notes because I'm actually literally writing up an interview related to this topic. Yeah, someone I was talking to, a scientist who's also an investor, said it takes on average 14 years to bring a drug to market. The failure rate at phase one, I apologize, is not 90%, it's 50%. Sorry, okay. I apologize there. That said, I also did a bit of Googling. For looking for some peer-reviewed academic papers, And I saw a data, for example, that 97% of cancer drugs fail during clinical trials. That's a lot, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think cancer is something that's a little more, yeah, although it receives a lot of funding, yeah, there's also different types and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think a lot of it's, you know, there's a lot put into these ideas around, yeah, you know, how do we get data from these trials that can be replicable, that it's, you know, it's rigorous, all that sort of thing. Back to Berkeley SciTech. I actually interviewed recently a VC fund focused on mental health, and they're kind of the world's first mental health focused VC. They're called Massawa. They're in Berlin, and also in the other founder is in, I think they're both in Berlin. No, what? No, the other one is in, let me check. I'm not sure. I can't tell. But basically, they have a very different approach to investing. It's not just the ideas they invest in, but they're also looking at, I guess, the mental health of the people they invest in. So they have this approach, which they call nurture capital, which extends across, you know, the idea that, you know, 65% of startup failures have been attributed to human conflict. So, you know, teams that don't get along and things like that. So they try and offer things like therapy, coaching, things like that.
All startups. So this is this is a startup for like conflict resolution.
Well, no, this is a VC doing it for their portfolio companies.
Okay.
And this,
you'd kind of hope that that was a standard thing to do.
Yeah, look, it's sort of coming. Like, I know.
Tough it up.
I know Cherry Ventures in March kicked off a program of, I guess, basically compulsory executive coaching for their networks. But I think the bit where Massawa stands out is they also support this idea called solidarity capital, which means 50% of their GP carry-on is tied to targets that they create with the founders.
What's GP carry-on?
So basically it means part of the money they get is used to support activities like not-for-profit activities and things like that. And they also have, I guess, through a foundation, which they manage. And it also means that, you know, part of the money that they get also goes to the founders. So it's a different way of approaching it. And it's quite an unusual one, but it's an interesting one. So I think it's pretty cool. And the other big news we saw last week was Hello Better, which is a German online therapy program, got 6 million euros. And why this company is interesting, it's basically because 6 of their programs have received approval from the German Federal Institute for Drugs and Medical Device, and they're integrated into the healthcare system for free for people with insurance. So you basically get a digital prescription to use these services. Yeah. Over 120,000 people have used them in Germany. And they've also...
Actually, explain that one again. I phased out for a second and then heard something I can maybe use. So say that again.
So they're basically online programs. So online therapy programs for different things.
Okay.
So panic disorder, for example, chronic pain, depression, stuff like that. And basically you go to the doctor prescribes you the app as a form of therapy, which you get for free because your health insurer covers it.
Mm. Have you heard much experience of people actually getting this? I mean, this is the problem you find with a lot of healthcare systems. It feels a little more pronounced here, but I'm pretty sure it's in a lot of places where, you know, these things exist, but it depends on someone giving you access to it who believes in it, et cetera, et cetera. Like, even for example, we now have this e-prescriptions here. I don't get that many prescriptions, but I haven't had a single one given to me. I don't know, like, what's supposed to happen.
Yeah, but in terms of Hello Better, I think 120,000 patients have used it. So that's that's a pretty good number. And now they're targeting the French market with a similar idea of getting the French health techs to pay for it for their companies. But I think I think these are cool ideas, and they kind of show that we're advancing in these areas, because there's often been so much focus on wellness and well-being apps as being and maybe wearables as being the core kind of components, but all of which were really strictly under that wellness category as opposed to a health category. So they weren't servicing people that had, I guess, psychiatric or mental health problems that were more of a health problem as opposed to, you know, something that required less intervention, if I can say that. And I think that's great. And the other one I just wanted to mention really quickly, a little shout out to a company called Hedepi, which is a Czech company. And they're the only one, I think, that actually has a, you know, a therapy a platform. So, you know, an online therapy where you can book in to see somebody to talk to. And they have both psychologists and psychiatrists on it. And they have, you know, to show you the demand for the psychiatrists, they've got over, when I spoke to them, they had over 150,000 people on, 1,500 people on the waiting list, which shows you, you know, there's a need for this kind of stuff, you know. And it's I like it. I like this company a lot because it really highlights the idea of actually responding to a problem, whereas a lot of people would have just done another meditation app or something. They're actually saying, well, no, this is a bigger structural problem that needs to be fixed. There's, you know, huge waiting lists in most cities for psychiatrists who need to be involved in everything from prescribing certain medications to diagnosing conditions like ADHD, for example. And so I think, you know, we're kind of in a good space with some of these things.
It's interesting you say this. This sort of feeds into, I'm not sure if it's the last time you spoke or the time before. We were talking about kind of vices and, you know, how things change. And I heard that there's now this, it depends on the country, of course, but there's this big sort of switch from in a lot of restaurants and bars and entertainment areas of incorporating well-being and health spaces instead of like restaurant or bar spaces. And it's interesting that there's this whole kind of movement at this, which I guess is positive, but I worry if it's become a new addiction, this sort of constant searching for something to fix your problems. And maybe we did it with alcohol and cigarettes before and now we do it with treatments. And, you know, it's hard to say whether one is actually more successful than the other or if it's just a new addiction. You know, there's gym addicts, there's this is where a lot of healthcare can turn into like something less positive if you're not careful. Cults and things like that. You know, we've also seen a lot of crossover between, I don't really want to name particular movements, but between certain healthcare movements and anti-vaxxers and all this kind of stuff. You know, it can they can very quickly turn from one thing to another.
For sure. And to be clear, the companies I've mentioned today, medically approved companies, they're either, you know, they're already got clearance in various countries or they're in the process. Yeah. They're not like a wellness app that anyone can enter into Apple Store or what have you without having any training or, you know, this has a science back, you know, a science backdrop. Yeah. Because I have written about that issue before, you know, the fact that if you look up wellness apps for mental health, most of them are that category as opposed to the.
Did you get much, especially with the thing that has content, did you get much impression though of how much that is ongoing? Because I mean, if you get it approved by some kind of regulatory body and then at some point 6 months in the future, you change your content drastically into something weird or esoteric, like do they recheck you periodically or?
Yeah. Okay. You mean like the therapy apps and stuff? Oh yeah. These are very, you know, rigorous programs. They're akin to the ones that you can get through, say, the NHS or something like that in the UK or what have you. And, you know, they're usually to be done, as I mentioned, like, for example, the app, the various programs through the app, you do need those prescribed by a doctor. So the idea is that you will have a doctor involved in some capacity, you know, checking in and stuff. It's not just like you pay for an app, you know. And I think it, you know, it's interesting because I did try a little while ago when my prescription had run out for something and I couldn't get an appointment to use one of the virtual doctors. And I tried two platforms and both of them just didn't work, you know. And I had to enter an awful lot of data to get to that point. You have to register an account and all this sort of stuff. And it was just, one of them kept crashing and the other one, the person kept leaving and I did it more out of interest to see what they were like because, you know, they are becoming an increasingly mainstream way of accessing healthcare, particularly for you know, your basic stuff where maybe, you know, like you want to get an allergy tablet, an asthma pump or something like that.
Okay. So it's not a therapy thing. It's a...
No, because there's a...
It's more of a... Yeah, I want to get this repeat prescription.
Yeah, like there's Arts Direct here and there's another one with a similar name that's got, you know, a doctor reference, I think, in the title. So there's a couple of, I mean, there's a...
But the other question is, though, of course, you know, often the biggest issue with the health industry is just a lack of qualified professionals. Mm. So if they're online, offline, down the road, on a Zoom call, but there's just not enough people, you know, what's the incentive for them to sign up to these things and have even more work? Because a doctor most of the time just sits in a surgery, like people coming to them or people calling them doesn't really change.
I think it's a good question. I mean, I don't know what the requirements are like for time, for example, because I assume doctors are billed for, you know, my knowledge of doctor's appointments is they're billed per the length of each appointment.
Yeah.
And so obviously longer ones, they get more money and so forth.
I've always been unsure of that because there always seems to be an incentive to be as quick as possible. I think it might be quantity of,
I guess it, you have to do the math on anything like this, right? Like, do you make more money doing lots of quick appointments or doing longer
ones?
Depends
on the system.
Completely. And this is part of the issue with, you know, how much you pay versus how much the health provider pays.
And out of interest, actually, we talk about the system. You know, a few of those, and this is a very European kind of business model, were reliant on getting funding from, in Germany's case, you know, mandated health insurance companies.
Exactly.
But the companies that weren't funded in that way, like how did they find getting business?
I mean, the ones I've mentioned are all ones that have been, I mean, their end goal is basically to have the health insurers cover their services for all of these companies because that's how you scale. And once you can prove it in one country, then you can prove it in the next one, you know?
But is that scaling? I don't know.
Well, if you go from one country to the next, that's scale.
But yes, because it puts a lot of your eggs in one basket.
No,
you know?
I mean, like, you know, if you're going from...
If you're reliant on a quote-unquote government funding, it's always a little precarious.
Well, I mean, I think you're not relying on the government funding. You're relying on the healthcare provider, the insurer,
no, for sure.
I guess.
But that's like a vendor...
Yeah, it is.
...connection. And if someone decides to change the vendor from you, then you've basically lost most of your business. You
know? Sure. But, I mean, they have contracts. And long procurement cycles for this kind of stuff, you know.
But on that as well, like, do they, in the German case, because this is the system I know best at the moment and it's sort of weird, like public-private hybrid, do they actually get the contract with each healthcare company or with the kind of association of healthcare companies?
I think it depends. Like, for example, Technica Krankenkasse might cover some things, whereas Bauma might cover something else. It depends on what you pay for. Basically, and that's often how the providers, I mean, they're legally required to cover X, but some of the ways they differentiate themselves is by adding adding extra things or what have you.
Or it's probably more the private companies.
And a lot of services that's, you know, you can certainly see a private practitioner. You can see a private doctor, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It usually gets you there faster, but it costs more. That's like the downside.
Yeah.
So this stuff does exist, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but I think I highlight it because I think it shows that, you know, we're moving beyond a lot of those kind of hyped, you know, wellness kind of ideas to things that are scientifically validated, which I think is kind of important when you're dealing with people's well-being and their heads and stuff, you know.
I'm not sure if one side of that statement is true. I think we are still very much in a lot of hyped welfare things.
Yeah, but, maybe.
Well-being stuff.
Fair.
But, yeah, I don't think that's ever going to change.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So just to sort of wrap this up, I mean, I know there's other kind of healthcare startups in Europe as well, some sort of medium-sized ones that are well-known here, like DoctorLib, which is a booking platform, which almost all doctors in Germany seem to use if you want to book online. Even if you book on the phone, they seem to then send you an appointment anyway.
Yeah, totally.
And also, you know, even if you go to the bigger end with pharmaceuticals like Bayer and the Swedish company that makes the controversial, you know, there's a lot, you know. How do you separate, I suppose, that... Someone like DoctorLib, I would kind of think, is kind of in your market.
Yeah.
Someone like Bayer isn't. You know, how do you separate where one becomes the other?
Oh, I see what you're saying. I mean, yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's something that we talk about periodically. I mean, when is a scale-up no longer a scale-up and it's just a big company, you know? I think it...
When is a startup just a company that's running out of money?
Well, and not a small business. That's a good question as well. I mean, look, partly it depends on reader interest. Like if we know readers are particularly interested in following the trajectory of a company as it scales, particularly if they're having problems and they, you know, they find how did you solve that or what have you. I think these are good stories. I think I would add as well that we do have this, I guess, flywheel effect in Europe, which, or everywhere really, which is this notion that as a company gets bigger, it's going to have natural attrition, which means people leave. And some of these people will start their own companies. So it brings that R&D and that entrepreneurship and what have you extended beyond that to other, you know, other sectors maybe, or different verticals or different niches within a sector, what have you, which again, and if they're doing this in, I guess, a European sense, like they're, you know, they're headquartered in Europe, it's keeping that kind of knowledge in Europe as opposed to sending it to the States or something like that.
Yeah. All right then. Well, I think it's an interesting space because it's one of those kind of ones you hope you never really need, but it's always good to know what's available.
Yeah, true.
Do, I suppose. So, all right then, let's take a quick break.
All right. Welcome back to the Tech Lounge. We have been talking about, I guess, mental health and psychiatry and a bunch of stuff along that side of the things. But now, Chris, what would you like to talk about today?
Something completely different.
Even better.
But on the subject of health, I don't know, I'm going to talk about open source health.
Oh, good topic.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So this week, well, the Monday, Tuesday was the, I think it's like three or 4 years now, maybe longer, event in Berlin, FOSS Backstage. Free and open source software backstage. Mm. It's, people tend to think of like FOSS software as mostly sort of engineering focused, and it's an event specifically aimed at the non-technical side. So equivalent things be like the community dev room at FOSSDEM. State of Open Con in London is also similar, although that's a bit more connecting with business and government. So it's talks around, you know, fundraising, regulation, governance, blah, blah, blah. But also other things like design. Just sort of, I guess, the topics that don't get talked about so much in other places. It's relatively small. It's at the venue that, as a English speaker, is very hard to take seriously because its acronym is BUM.
That's anyway, unfortunate.
Let's move on from
that's
that quickly in my immature thoughts.
All right. So tell me about the conference. What did you like and what didn't you like?
I don't really want to go into what I – well, what I didn't like was one of the rooms was just too hot. But that's not really –
just in a general sense. Yeah.
It's quite small. I think that's – it's not really a criticism of the event, but I think it's more an unfortunate representation of these sorts of topics, is that it's like the classic case in so much with sort of engineering-related things is everyone always says, oh, this is really important. But none of the people who actually need to hear it ever turn up, you know. It tends to be a lot of preaching to the converted or the same kind of faces, that kind of thing, which is unfortunate. You know, what you really want is all these engineers turning up to hear about this stuff. But in reality, that's very few, and it tends to be the people already heavily involved. But, I mean, whatever. That's kind of normal,
yeah.
I suppose,
yeah, I think
these
you're
sorts
right.
of things. Yeah. But I guess obviously this has a predominantly European perspective, and there's obviously been a lot. Whilst some of the topics that were discussed were not necessarily new, like digital sovereignty, the DMA, these sorts of European regulations, you know, I think, in fact, the first talk I'm looking at says digital sovereignty and open source, shaping an answer to geopolitical instabilities. You know, there's definitely a lot of accelerated thought and action around certain topics because of things happening in certain parts of the world, shall we say, and what Europe can, could, should do about that to protect itself from undue influence. And we also find ourselves in, you know, situations like even from within, you know, the UK government recently wanting Apple to close its enhanced protection feature because they wanted backdoors, you know. So European governments are not always allies.
That's
either.
A good point.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll have a look at – let me go quickly. So there was a talk from Mirko, who we have both met actually because he was a best man at someone's wedding.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Works for Linux Foundation EU, who I have interviewed on the show late 2020. I think, talking about implementing the EU Cyber Resilience Act. And this has particular relevance to the open source world because there were early concerns mm-hmm. that anyone maintaining an open source project suddenly had to have more things to be concerned about. And this actually got worked on by, and I think this is where this discussion and events like this and people involved in these spaces can have an impact because often the EU actually puts out policies as discussion or as discussion pieces, and there is an opportunity to influence them. They're not always set in stone. And the EU Cyber Resilience Act is one example of where the open source community said, this doesn't really work for us. And it was recognized that that was important to accommodate. So certain compensations were made and things like that. So, you know, I think it's always an interesting example of showing that whilst it's not always easy to find the resources or know that the opportunity is mm-hmm. there for you to interact, you can. And whether that be individually or being involved with bodies that do, like Linux Foundation EU, like Freedom Software Foundation EU, like all of these kind of groups that tend to do that. Yeah, any questions so far?
Yeah, I mean, I've got one question for you. I mean, something that pops up a lot when I write about European reform and stuff like that is the propensity to have lots of discussion, lots of meetings, lots of petitions, and it takes, you know, a long time to get to a concrete action.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
In the software space, how does it compare?
It's not much different. Not much different at all, and this is a problem in itself. Even this act in particular has had a fairly long process, and Mirko, I think, joked that he'd be doing the same talk for at least a couple of years.
Oh, God.
But just some of the details change each time. And also things get delayed or distracted. You know, there's other things happening in the world. I think there was a process that was supposed to have been resolved 3 months ago, and that's been delayed. It could be that, you know, there's other things.
I mean, how these kinds of initiatives, who makes the decisions?
So, yeah, this is where things get often interesting as well and often misunderstood, especially by American companies and commentators, is that often there is an act, but it's up to each jurisdiction in the European Union to apply and enforce it. And that can take different – and interpret, so it can take different forms. And this is where often, you know, the criticisms of some EU regulation, like the cookies, GDPR, can be problematic because they don't always mean anything. They may mean some inconvenience, but actually when it comes to enforcing, to fining, et cetera, not much really happens. I will say that that has changed. I think GDPR was a bit of a watershed moment of realizing that things need to be handled and they have got better. So the DMA has been a bit more effective with getting fines out and getting things happening and getting back and forth and et cetera, et cetera. I suppose the criticism and concern at the moment is that if we say probably the one main country that houses a lot of companies that tend to get targeted is the US.
Yeah.
And with a US administration that is pretty combative. And also adopting an attitude of couldn't care less about standards and things like that. How effective will these things be? Will the big companies that often get targeted go to the administration and say, hey, the EU keeps being nasty to us. Do something about it.
Uh-huh.
And be relatively easy to have a lot of kind of, you know, retaliatory tariffs and things against, well, you find Meta. So we're going to put a tariff on Meta. I don't know how that would work, but you know what I mean.
Like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, a related question. I mean, we've seen, I guess it, I say US, but obviously it affects everybody who uses the services. We've seen this kind of pushback from like Microsoft and Meta and a bunch of the other companies to remove, for example, their diversity, equity, inclusion from not only explicitly their websites, like in terms of the language they use, but also things they fund and so forth. And given, I don't know, I always get the impression with open source software, there's always a big push towards diversity. And I'm curious whether any of those topics are coming up when you're in kind of an open source space talking about, you know, policy and changes and all that sort of stuff. Or maybe not yet.
Actually, I mean, in this particular event, not so much. This is probably an event that has a tendency to be more diverse than a coding event, which says something in itself, unfortunately. I can see a few talks on the agenda about it. There was something from an African community, and this is actually something that has come up a bit with some conversations I've had and that's sort of the interview stream of this podcast a little bit, of how a lot of open source communities are getting a lot of input from Africa and Asia.
Interesting.
And Latin America to a certain extent that, and especially in Asia, the language barrier sometimes means that they're not actually very aware of the activity. Africa has a tendency to speak a lot of like French or English. So languages that European communities and American communities to a certain extent can interact with. But then in Asia, you have languages that are, you know, there's less common denominator of English, for example. Sure. So there is a lot of diversity out there that is a bit untapped sometimes. And in Africa and India, the issue tends to be cost of being involved plus visa issues.
That's the point. I mean, I think people take it for granted how easy it is to travel across the world when you live in Europe.
But there's also talks here on multilingual design, which was interesting. So a little, there was a little actually.
Very interesting. Related note to my multilingual, I'm talking to a company next week that does transcription software, but one of their sort of specialties is accents, which I think is really interesting because that can be quite a challenge when you're transcribing sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And then actually some of the other ones I found there was a talk from an economist who, you know, there's often a lot of talks around justifying open source departments, justifying open source as a business value. I mean, generally speaking, that has sort of, depending on the company, largely been demonstrated. But when it comes to sort of smaller projects sustaining themselves, this is a constant problem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's a classic XKCD comic. There's many others of, you know, everything dependent on one guy in Sweden maintaining curl or something like this.
Exactly.
I can't think of the exact details. But this is actually an interesting talk about showing different financial models for monetizing open source or showing the benefit, that kind of thing. So this is often something that comes up. But that was an interesting perspective on just showing you different ways to do it. Yeah. And it's a level above the sort of – like there's lots of tools and communities around getting metrics and things like that. But metrics are only useful if you have a reason for having them.
Good point.
Or a thing you're trying to demonstrate, that kind of thing.
I think you raised a really interesting point, though, the fact that we're having these conversations around things like the economics of things like open source software. I'm seeing it in health sciences, like the conference I went to in Riyadh, where they also had economists talking about, you know, aging, how do we price that and so forth. But it really, I think it adds an air of expansiveness and shows sort of the broader impact that tech is having everywhere, you know? Because you're going to have specialty people that are able to, you know, have one, you've got, I guess, a better glut of data now, so you can actually analyze some of these things and have sort of real data that you can make recommendations or you can make findings from. Mm. But you've also got sort of a broader recognition of the value of tech, I guess, and software and so forth, which I think is really, really good, actually.
Yeah. And I think within big companies, they can sort of value open source. You know, Microsoft is the famous example of a company that now fully embraces it. But it's that smaller teams and projects, and especially the older stuff that gets left aside a bit. Like, I'm often amazed with the interviews I hear with maintainers of really, really common key components that have been going for 20, 30 years, and it funds one person.
Basically. So interesting. And it really, not to be morbid, but if that person gets hit by a bus, you know?
Well, this used to be the adage, but they try to use a different term now, which is what if that person won the lottery, which I don't think is very, accurate because I think coders probably still keep coding.
The other thing I would add to that is also what if they, what was I going to say?
Just got bored.
Oh, yeah. I mean, COVID was a great example, wasn't it? Was it COVID? During COVID, they were bringing in all the COBOL developers?
Yeah. Actually, the bigger issue is sometimes like the malicious injection. There was a couple of examples a year or so ago of people getting maintainer access to open source projects and injecting things in.
Oh.
And often things can sneak through very easily. I'm actually doing some work now for a company that's using AI on open source projects to help maintainers. And we're going to have a few topics on this, like actually ironically using AI to fight AI.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, because a lot of people have been seeing an increase in not really malicious, but just waste, time-wasting contributions and popular.
To your knowledge, I mean, it's a hard one to know, I guess. Or maybe you do know. Are the comments administered by people or bots? Too hard a question, maybe.
To coin a German phrase, yang? Yes or no?
Yeah, but no, as we say in Israel.
I mean, there is an argument to say that sometimes a human spam machine is cheaper than a robot one. Doesn't make them any better or worse.
That's kind of great.
In honesty, some of the new AI-powered comments can be more convincing than a human's. Yeah, so both.
Yeah, right. I think. Interesting.
Yeah. So it was an interesting event. I didn't stay for all of it. I missed a lot of the second day. I actually need to look back on. In fact, I'm seeing some of the talks that you were asking me about. It's like, oh, I really actually want to go and watch that now. I think a lot of them are, it's the kind of event that they probably put stuff available for.
Probably on YouTube.
Free. I'm not sure.
I'm finding that's it. I mean, in my experience, that's been really great that a lot of the conferences I go to, they do put things on YouTube or they have a sign in. Because
sure.
I'm, as most journalists, when I go to events, I'm often working as well. And I just don't get the time to focus.
Honestly, between you and me, Kate, how many of them have you ever got to watching? Or how many conferences from 3 years ago are you still on your to watch list?
A few. just one or two, maybe.
One or two.
100.
100, no.
Yeah, there's a few. There's a few, yeah. But, I mean, that's it. I think it's, it's kind of great still.
All right then, Kate. So let's wrap up. What do you want to promote? And how can people get in touch with you?
I don't have anything explicitly to promote. I've got a couple of pieces I'm working on that might take a bit of time and I may be able to share them depending on the outcome of those. Bit of investigative journalism there. But if you're always welcome to contact me, I am on LinkedIn under my name, which is Kate Lawrence, Kate with a C, Lawrence with a W. I'm also on Blue Sky and Threads. What about you, Chris? How can people contact you?
Yeah. I'm on christianchiller.com. I had a couple of videos that go out this week, varying topics. One is a profile of a tool called AquaVoice that lets you interact with your computer whilst dictating. So it's kind of dictation plus control at the same time.
That's cool.
Kind of interesting. I also left up the incorrect Adobe Premiere transcription to show you how much more accurate AquaVoice, which is also quite good. I will have a video coming out. Actually, it should be out by the time this publishes on a guide to ASCII doc. Mm-hmm. And I have a bunch of blog posts in progress. And I'm trying to panickingly finish a book on sustainable computing.
Yes, that will be something we have to promote very well once it comes out. Because I think
get back to some fun writing or blogging for my own purpose.
That's often
as well.
The problem, right? Yeah. You have to do the work.
I also need to resurrect my to-do aggregator app, which will be popular for any kind of freelancer or contractor, because now I kind of abandoned it for a little while because I was mostly using the same tools, but now between several clients, I'm on about six.
Can you
tools.
Explain what it is just quickly?
So for example, I currently between all my clients have tasks assigned in GitHub, in Trello, in Jira, in Linear, in Notion, and I would like to be able to see them all in one place.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's basically what I've been working on for a while, and I keep kind of chipping away at it, but now I really need it again. So I think I'm encouraged to try and finish it.
Cool. Yeah. That sounds great. Very necessary.
All right then. So, and if you listen to this episode, I highly recommend you go back a week and listen to my interview with Dave Thomas from Heroku in Sarajevo last year. He's one of these kind of grand... It's weird we could say grand old dame, but we don't really say grand old duke. But one of these sort of legends of the computing industry, he wrote The Pragmatic Programmer 20 to 30 years ago.
Yeah, right.
He helped write the Agile Manifesto, and he runs his own publishing company now.
Right.
So and it was an interesting conversation, a nice wander through computing history and stuff. And he's an English guy who lives in the States, so has sort of a mixed perspective on these
things. Interesting. That sounds like some really good content there. And you'll hopefully put that in the show notes. Some of the links, perhaps.
Sure. But I mean, the podcast episode you will find just by going back to the last episode, but the rest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay, great. And I will also put some links in just in case anyone wants to have a look.
Or to be precise, Kate, I will put some links.
Well, yes. Correct.
All right, then. Thanks again, Kate. Talk to you soon.
Have a good afternoon. Bye all.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.